Get your exterior painting to-dos done easily with Dutch Boy Pristine Exterior Paint. With its rain rinse technology, rain naturally washes away dirt and grime. Plus, it resists cracking and peeling, making it perfect to withstand the harshest weather conditions. Save big money on Pristine Exterior Paint and start your painting project today. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening this week. Save big money at
Welcome to Scoop, where you get the scoop on this week's news. My name is Jenna, and this is Smarter News. Welcome to Scoop, where you get the scoop on this week's news. My name is Jenna, and this is Smarter News, and it's Monday, August 11th, 2025. And I'm so glad to see you today. We got kind of shot out of a cannon this morning with news because the president made an announcement about how he would like to and is going to try to change the course in Washington, D.C. when it comes to safety and beautification, his words, of the city. There are those that disagree with his assessment of Washington, D.C. and what he's doing as far as putting some of the D.C. Agencies, and we're going to get into this a little bit, underneath federal power. D.C. is interesting. We all think about Washington, D.C. likely as just another American city. I mean, that's sort of how I think about it. But we have to really step back and look at D.C. in the unique way that it's set up for its own or lack of government, because it's very unique in the United States. And so Washington, D.C. is connected to the federal government in ways that other cities simply are not. And so we got news from the president today on this. I have a lot of sound for you on that, including sound from the D.C. mayor, who really just over the last 24 hours painted a completely different picture using data about what's going on in the city itself. So let me just put that aside for a second. We're going to get to that big news. We have some big diplomatic stories that we're going to be covering this week as well for some of our largest conflicts that we've been covering, the war between Israel and Hamas and the ongoing conflict, ongoing war between Russia and Ukraine. So news on that as well. And of course, I look forward to taking your questions live. For those of you who are joining us live as insiders, thank you so much for your support of Smarter News. I was away for the last week, so we didn't get our regular scoop broadcast last week because I was actually in Yosemite, which I'm going to have some reporting for you from there. I have to sift through a few different things. You always learn something when you're on the road. It's great to have a little distance. And as we've talked about it in the past several weeks, Wi-Fi has been an issue all summer for me, no matter where I am in the United States. I don't know if it's me. I feel like maybe the full moon, right? Over the last, maybe I needed some crystals, sage. I don't know. But I have felt a little bit cursed when it comes to Wi-Fi. Now in Yosemite, that was also the case, but we're in a really big national park with a lot of rocks. So I didn't get to do kind of my regular come along with me for this trip. And it was good to have a little bit of distance just to think, you know, walking down a long trail that's much longer than you expected, for example, with your three kids gives you a lot of time to think. And it was nice to have a little bit of that separation. So thank you for the grace that you gave me last week as we were keeping up with the news and had a great team back here at home doing that, but also trying to take some time away for family. Now, while I'm away, I am the person in the airport that will buy the local newspaper. You may go into these stores at the airport and wonder who buys these newspapers. And then you'll think to yourself, oh, Jenna from Smarter News, like show me the one that buys these newspapers. I love having a real newspaper in my hand. Old fashioned, I know. But I also like supporting local newspapers because we know that the local newspaper is really important. Journalism on a local level is extremely important. And if there's a way that I can support just by simply purchasing a paper, I always do. My hometown paper that my family bought was the San Francisco Chronicle. And so I had the San Francisco Chronicle in front of me. I read a little bit about some local issues. Also, it was interesting to get a different perspective on some of our bigger national stories like ICE and immigration and get it from the point of view of San Francisco and in California, which San Francisco is a sanctuary city. California is a sanctuary state. It's just a different point of view on a big story that I'm reporting on from Texas as also a border state. But again, there's always a little bit of a vantage point from where you're sitting on a regular basis that can be empowering as a journalist, but also limiting. And it's always good to be aware of that. I'm going to start off today, though, with a story that has nothing to do with anything important. I just hope that it makes you laugh and makes you think as we kind of glide into this week and some of these very serious stories that we do have in front of us. So when you read a local newspaper, you do find things that you wouldn't otherwise find. And this is one of them. This is by Mackenzie Chung Fagan, who is San Francisco Chronicle's restaurant critic. And I'm showing it to those of you that are watching live. You're seeing that this is indeed a real paper. Let me read to you the title. People are bringing own food to Bay Area eateries. Is purse tuna ever okay? Purse tuna. Yes. Purse tuna, like tuna that you have in your purse. All right. How did this restaurant critic get onto this story? Let me read this to you. My journey into the dark underbelly of the BYO food movement, bring your own food movement, began with a direct message from Contimo, a Napa cafe that serves breakfast and lunch. Quote, we've noticed a surprising and increasing trend, guests bringing outside food or even home-cooked meals into our restaurant. Owner Ryan Harris wrote, it's now a daily occurrence. And he wondered if other businesses were also dealing with this situation, and if so, how they were tackling it. So Mackenzie got on the case. And what she found is, yes, indeed, a lot of local eateries in and around the Bay Area are dealing with this problem of people actually bringing in entire meals into a restaurant. We're not talking about like their own water bottle or like maybe a hard-boiled egg. I have been guilty of doing that periodically into a coffee shop where I know I'm going to work for a little bit. Might have a few hard-boiled eggs in my purse. Maybe tuna. I could have done tuna at one time. That seems a little bit more odd though with the cappuccino, but you know, son, you got to get your protein. We're all stressed out about that. All right. Here's another quote from Kate Riker, the chef at the famously meat-free restaurant Greens. Okay. Meat-free restaurant. This is a quote. Once a lady pulled a whole rotisserie chicken out of her purse and started putting it on her salad. On another occasion, there was quote unquote purse tuna, two words that I wish I had never seen side by side. So this was interesting. It went on to ask this question of like, why people are doing this? Like, why are they doing this? And according to an intern for the San Francisco Chronicle, this is more common among younger people. If a group of friends is eating at a restaurant, but you can't afford to, maybe you're going to bring in a little snack and you're going to join your friends. You're going to sit there, but you're not going to order. There were some restaurateurs who said, listen, if someone brought in their own favorite topping for a pizza that we're putting on the table, like we love that. That's no big deal. But a rotisserie chicken in a meat-free restaurant sounds like a little bit, who has the nerve to do that? So my question is, even if that's not someone that's worried about cost, you know, you're bringing in a chicken to a restaurant, I don't know. So my question for you is, how do you feel about purse tuna? Have you seen this yourself? Now, maybe a few exceptions being the cafeteria style eating place. You know, what happens if you had friends eating at Chipotle or Sweetgreens or something that's more of a chain? They sat down, you had lunch, so you joined them at a table. I mean, I think I might see myself doing that potentially, but I would buy a drink or something from the restaurant, even if my friends had bought something. Because that would be weird. But a restaurant with a server where you bring in your own food? Yes. I am so curious about what you think about that. Robin says, what the crackers? A whole chicken in your bag? Yeah, I like that. What the crackers? That is our new scoop saying. What the crackers? Kathy is asking, isn't that some sort of health or safety issue? I mean, I agree. Emily has a theory. People literally went crazy after COVID. No concept of social norms. I do agree with that. Some of what we considered normal behavior, you know, we've challenged it, you know? Let's see. Debbie Lynn finally made it to live show. Hi, Debbie. Leanne says that is rude. And let's see. One more insight from Robin, who is living in the Bay Area, by the way. She says, I did watch a woman in a restaurant on Jackson and Fillmore, a very popular area, feed her cat with a fork Well, it's on the lab. So purse tuna, that is our phrase of the week, along with what the crackers. All right. I think crackers would be okay to bring into a restaurant. Gluten-free crackers, that's okay. I don't know. Listen, you heard it here first. San Francisco Chronicle giving us the scoop on purse tuna. I'm going to feel really, I am going to feel a little bit self-conscious if I do pull something out of my purse now. I'm going to be very sensitive to it. But different economic times, different social times. Is the restaurant changing? I don't know. I'll leave that for you to contemplate as we move on to some of our big stories of the week. So two big diplomatic stories that are sitting in front of us that no matter where we're living, no matter where we're eating, we will likely see in the news this week. And I'm just going to touch on both of these briefly. I was going to do a deeper dive on them, but the news about Washington, D.C. sort of bigfooted them in this moment. And I believe we're going to have some time to speak about these probably later on in the week as they develop. So we have a meeting between the Russian President, Vladimir Putin, and President Trump in Alaska that's taking place on Friday. This is significant. Anytime there's a face-to-face meeting between the Russian President and any American president, it's a very big deal because it's a sign of potentially thawing relations between our two countries. America's policy over the last several years, even including the first Trump administration, although he tried to have a different relationship with Russia, has been one of isolation. You know, Russia is not part of the inner circle. They're not part of the cool kids club. They're being isolated diplomatically. They're also being isolated economically as a way to try to force a change in their decisions when it comes to Ukraine and their invasion of Ukraine that is continuing to fall into a time of a lot of attacks. You know, I was looking at some reporting that was being done by the Wall Street Journal and others this weekend. And if you look at the pace and the number of attacks of Russia on Ukraine, it's at some of the highest levels that we've seen in the war so far. So this escalation of what's happening in Ukraine continues, although our front pages, I know that's sort of an old-fashioned expression, seem to be focused on other things. It seems to be the norm that you're going to get a story about an attack in Ukraine. And maybe we don't realize that these attacks have become more severe, pardon me, and the pace has increased over the last several months with the new Trump administration. So now there's going to be this meeting. And remember, President Trump over the last several weeks has said, listen, if I don't see any progress when it comes to ceasefire, we're going to levy all of these different tariffs on Russia. They are going to affect those that are customers of Russia, which, by the way, are some American allies like India. India is a big buyer of Russian oil. China, big buyer of Russian oil. And we're going to try to squeeze Russia economically, because we know that may elicit some sort of change in behavior if there's public pressure on Vladimir Putin to do something different. That's been some of the thinking behind this. Whether or not that would actually lead to a change is another question entirely. But this meeting, which is scheduled for Friday, is important because this would be the first meeting of these two during this administration. We would watch body language. We would watch content. We would watch to see, is there any sort of negotiations that could elicit a change in the course of this war? What is being reported on the table so far, and again, this is just reports on reports, is that Russia would be open to saying the territory that it has invaded and essentially taken over the last decade. Remember, the war between Russia and Ukraine had a start in the recent years, but also we can go back to 2014, 2015, when there was a massive invasion by Russia in the eastern side of Ukraine. And a lot of really tough fighting happened at that time. Territory was taken. Russia says it's theirs and annexes territory. And culturally, this territory did have ties to Russia as well. And so there's some talk that if Russia could officially take this territory, not the new land that it went into during this latest fighting, but get some territory, would this be an opening for ceasefire? But you know that we've reported that Ukraine does not want to give up any territory at all. And so then it would be a question about whether or not Ukraine would be open to officially ceding territory to Russia. You know, we think about maps as looking the same way wherever we are in the world, and we know that that's just not the case. If I look at a map of Ukraine, I see Ukraine as it has been for the, you know, the last decade plus. But in Russia, Russia's seeing parts of Ukraine saying, no, that's our territory. This is our annexed territory. And so could we get some sort of geographical agreement that would lead to a ceasefire that would be acceptable? Big question about President Zelensky attending or not attending. There was some reporting, I thought it was very kind of loose reporting, that President Zelensky could be invited to this meeting. President Trump talked about this today at the White House, and you know, he said, well, maybe at some point, but really this is about the American president and the Russian president. And so just knowing it's on the calendar is important. If you see that it's canceled, that's going to be big news. And as we get an understanding of what it's going to look like, are they going to have an hour meeting? Are they going to have lunch? What is this going to look like? This is just every bit as important. These aren't just, you know, frivolous details. This is important to understanding what's the nature of this relationship. What is this going to look like? What is the image that's going to be projected to the world? And how is that going to play out for both President Trump and Vladimir Putin? What do they both want from this meeting, and how do they both achieve it? In the past, there was some critique of President Trump not looking strong enough. You know, the Western media during his first administration was saying, well, he was too basically nice to Vladimir Putin. And, you know, he didn't look as strong as he needed to look. You know, clearly, President Trump would disagree with that. And what I would say to you is look at the video as it comes out. See what is your takeaway? What is your human reaction to these two individuals and how they're talking? How do you see it? Don't let anyone categorize it for you. This is going to be really interesting to watch, especially as it's set up. And so we're going to watch for the coordination in the days that lead up to this and what we see. You know, do we see a ratcheting down of bombing of Ukraine or a ratcheting up? In recent days, even with this meeting on the horizon, Russia continues this awful bombing of Ukraine. So a lot can happen between now and Friday. I just want you to know it's there, and we'll see if it takes place. Interesting to note that Alaska was purchased from Russia in the 1860s by America for around $7 million, just over $7 million. Not, you know, people say, oh, that's not like chump change. But if you look at it in inflation terms, you know, it wasn't an insignificant purchase. And the fact that it was taking place at the same time, you know, this was all sort of coming together at the end of the Civil War. America's emerging as a new country, having gone through this awful period. Kind of interesting to think about Alaska coming on board during that time as a new territory for the United States of America. So that's where that meeting is going to be taking place. All right, let's talk a little bit about what's going on when we look at Gaza. And I want to just flag something for you. I've noticed recently in the media that instead of referring to the people of Gaza as Palestinians, they're being referred to as Gazans. I'm very curious about this. I don't have, you know, like a strong editorial opinion on it. I think you could refer to people that live in Gaza as Gazans. I think you could refer to them as Palestinians, as has been the background that links the Palestinians in this area together culturally. And you can see Palestinians in a lot of different places in the West Bank, in Syria, in Jordan. You could see Palestinians in Israel. I don't want to say it's a generic term, but it's a large umbrella. Gazans would be very specific to those that live in Gaza. And I'm curious about that, especially as we're hearing about more European nations talking about acknowledging a Palestinian state. I'm just wondering if the language is intentional, or if we're trying, the media is trying to be more specific, or what this is about. Just, I don't really know what to make of it. I think one of the things that we do well here at Smart News is flag something like that and ask that question. Well, what is, when we start talking about this group of people as Gazans, how does that change the way that the story is being told around the world? And if we're talking about Palestinian statehood, then are we talking about the Gazans? You see how I'm saying? These terms matter. And it's one of the things that has been a major challenge for this story, as we've talked about the sourcing of information coming out of Gaza and also the way that the world is telling the story about what's happening there. So the latest news is that Israel over the last several days has become more specific, in a lot of ways came full circle to an idea that was first introduced a few months ago with the Trump administration coming into office, that Israel would take over Gaza and would not permanently supervise Gaza, but would not allow Hamas to be part of the power structure, that this would be the final move by Israel going into these key areas of Gaza, where they believe that Hamas still is, and evacuating the people to quote unquote safe zones, clearing out these areas and taking over the Gaza Strip. Again, something that was floated several months ago and then was sort of lost momentum. And then there was questions about, you know, hostage negotiations. So what does this look like? We had a couple of hostages freed and some not freed. And we've seen this back and forth about negotiations between Hamas and Israeli counterparts, and we haven't seen a lot of progress. We've seen rising concerns about the conditions in Gaza, out of humanitarian concern for the children that are living there. Israel continues to say that aid is flowing freely into Gaza, but not being distributed appropriately by the UN, and accusing Hamas of disrupting that. There are those that say that's not the case, that Israel's distribution of food is as faulty and dangerous as anything else, and they are purposely trying to starve the people that remain as a way to try to get to Hamas. There's a lot of these different claims. As we've talked about, I wish I could square these claims and say this is where we arrive, but these continue to be the two pictures that are being presented to the world. What's important here is that you have Israel pushing this more, I would say severe, but a more aggressive military operation, and saying this is what's going to happen, this is the plan. And we know that ceasefire negotiations are continuing behind closed doors, but we're not seeing a whole lot of progress. In the meantime, Israel targeted a group of people that worked for Al Jazeera. Al Jazeera says these are well-known journalists that were purposely targeted by the Israeli government. Israel says very directly that these were actually Hamas operatives. And I want to show you this, if I can pull it up here on X, because one of the things I'm noticing is that in the early reporting of this, we did not, I'm not seeing a lot of the press quote Israel's assessment of what, you know, was taking place. And I want you to be able to see it. So Israel says this. Israel is not denying that this group of people were targeted. In fact, they're very specific in what they said that they did. And this is what Israel's Defense Forces says: struck, and it has a little target emoji. Hamas terrorist Anas al-Sharif, who posed as an Al Jazeera journalist. Al-Sharif was the head of a Hamas terror cell and advanced rocket attacks on Israeli civilians and IDF troops. Intelligence and documents from Gaza, including rosters, terrorist training lists, and salary records, prove he was a Hamas operative integrated into Al Jazeera. A press badge isn't a shield for terrorism, and they say that they have these different details that show that that's the case. Al Jazeera clearly denies this and says that that's not the case, that this is one of the most well-known journalists that was continuing to report in Gaza, a father of two, a young journalist that was purposely being targeted because he was highlighting what was happening to the people in Gaza, and therefore it was his reporting, not his connection to Hamas, is the reason why Israel targeted this person, and what Al Jazeera says is a targeted assassination. So those are the two different pictures. One thing that is missing from this, and this will be a little controversial, but I think you should know this: Al Jazeera is owned and operated essentially by the government of Qatar. So Qatar is that nation that we've talked quite a bit about, which provides safe haven to Hamas operatives, but it's also an ally of the United States. If we're doing negotiations with Hamas operatives, we're going to Qatar to do that. If we're doing negotiations with the Taliban, we're going to Qatar to do that. Qatar is a place of strategic importance to the United States, and we have a really strong relationship with them. However, there have been questions raised about Qatar's relationships with different groups, including terrorist organizations like Hamas. And while it is known that Qatar has sent a lot of money to Gaza, there's always been the question about whether or not they could also be funding Hamas. So there is a question in using Al Jazeera at times in the Middle East, a question about their independence of reporting, just like we have questions here at home about the independence of certain news networks and whether or not there's a political agenda driving these news networks. That same sort of shadow also extends to Al Jazeera, with a question about a point of view or of a flexibility in their reporting and the way that they're reporting on terrorism that would not be done in the United States in the same way. you know, that said, as a journalist and someone who loves journalism and wants to see journalists able to work all over the world safely, it's difficult to also say that out loud because there's a question of, well, you know, there's so many different news organizations now that have a particular point of view, that editorial point of view kind of shades the reporting, and you may question using them as a source. So that's one of the reasons I don't use Al Jazeera a lot as a source, because there's been this question. This question is for years. This is for decades. This is not like a new question that's come up. This was a question as well during the Iraq War, in the Middle East, in Afghanistan. Al Jazeera can have great access, but you then have to question, well, how do they get that access? And what's happening behind the scenes? So it's just important to know that. I'm not validating Israel's move at targeting who they say is a terrorist. And I can't confirm Al Jazeera's claim as well. So you have two different points of view. And this is a story that's getting international attention. One of the things we are seeing statistically, though, is that the number of journalists that have been killed in Gaza is one of the highest numbers that we've seen in recent conflicts. It's a very, very dangerous place to work. There's not a lot of access, as we've talked about. That's a huge issue for this story and one that we have to continue to remember. So just want to make sure that you had that on your radar as well. These negotiations are continuing. Could we see also some sort of breakthrough in diplomacy this week when it comes to Israel and Hamas? We don't know, but we're going to continue to watch for it. All right, let's talk a little bit about what happened in Washington, D.C. today. And to do that, I'd like you to see the very beginning and a few key parts of this press conference that President Trump held. It was more of a press briefing where he came in front of the press briefing room at the White House, and we knew he was going to deliver a statement. And he also took some questions. So it's sort of like a little mini news conference along with this announcement. So here's a little bit of sound from earlier today.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
Wow. I've been up here a lot. I've never seen a crowd like this. I think we need a ballroom, and that's happening. It's going to be a beautiful ballroom. This is really a lot of people, most I've ever seen in this room. And we're here for a very serious purpose, very serious purpose. Something's out of control, but we're going to put it in control very quickly, like we did on the southern border. Today, we're formally declaring a public safety emergency. This is an emergency. This is a tragic emergency. And it's embarrassing for me to be up here. You know, I'm going to see Putin. I'm going to Russia on Friday. I don't like being up here talking about how unsafe and how dirty and disgusting this once beautiful capital was, with graffiti all over the walls. It's another part of it, by the way. Because we're talking about safety, but we're also talking about beautification. We have the most beautiful, potentially, capital in the world. We always had. But people come from Iowa, they come from Indiana, they come and then they get mugged. Not going to happen. Keep coming, because within, by the time you get your trip set, it's going to be safe again, and it's going to be clean very quickly. So today we're declaring public safety emergency in the District of Columbia, and Attorney General Pam Bondi, who's fantastic, is taking command of the Metropolitan Police Department as of this moment.
Can you talk about how personal of an issue this is? You talked about flying over the Washington Monument and seeing the pride of what D.C. is. And do you believe that the status of the city, the cleanliness, the way that crime is low, is a direct reflection on how the country is run?
Yeah, I do. I think the Capitol, look, everyone comes here. They're all coming. All the leaders, they're all wanting to come. It's a very, very strong reflection of our country. You know, my father always used to tell me, I had a wonderful father, very smart. And he used to say, son, when you walk into a restaurant and you see a dirty front door, don't go in. Because if the front door is dirty, the kitchen's dirty also. Same thing with the Capitol. If our Capitol's dirty, our whole country is dirty. And they don't respect us. So it's a very good question, actually.
Mr. President.
I wanted to share with you that part of the soundbite because President Trump rarely talks about his family. And I thought that was a real vivid sort of anecdote about how he was viewing this problem as he sees it. And you can tell that it's really two things that he's concerned about. He's concerned about crime, and he's also concerned about that the way that the city is presenting itself, not only to Americans that are visiting, but also to world leaders that are coming in to visit as well and to have meetings. One of the things that he mentioned several times in this press briefing, press conference, was a mention of medians, like the medians on a road, and that when you drive through the streets, some of the medians are cracked or falling over, and he really doesn't like that. And so in some ways, it was interesting to listen to him talk about this because you saw his real estate mind really at work and thinking about the graffiti. He'd talk about the graffiti, and then he was talking about crime. Then he was talking about the media, and then he was talking about the roads. And he would say, you know, it was really the whole thing clearly is bothering him. He doesn't like the crime, and he doesn't like what he's seeing as far as just the aesthetics. Now, as far as crime, I want to show some of this to you. The president had some specific claims. I'm going to play his claims, and then we're going to talk a little bit about what some of the statistics are showing in Washington, D.C., and I want you to hear from the mayor as well. But here's also, just so you get a little bit more of a flavor of what he was saying and some of the language that he was using, I thought this, you know, minute or so was also good and important for you to hear.
Our neighborhoods are now under emergency curfews. Just this past weekend, gunfire went through, and you saw that, the Navy Yard. I saw it this morning. They saw that they fought back against, see, they fight back until you knock the hell out of them, because it's the only language they understand. But they fought back against law enforcement last night, and they're not going to be fighting back long because I've instructed them and told them whatever happens, you know, they love to spit in the face of the police as the police are standing up there in uniform. They're standing and they're screaming at them an inch away from their face. And then they start spitting in their face. And I said, you tell them, you spit and we hit. And they can hit real hard.
Okay, again, I wanted you to get some of the language that he's using, how he's talking about this. I'm seeing some really good insight from those of you who are joining us live. Kathy says, our daughter and son-in-law live in the Capitol Hill area. We go often and never feel unsafe. Leanne said this, I go there several times a year for work. Every morning, I go to the Lincoln Monument to say good morning to Abe. I love that, Leanne. I have gone alone and never felt unsafe. Jackie says this, I lived on Capitol Hill for about a year before getting married. I always felt very safe, even as a single woman walking around. Here's what's key about your feedback. This is really important. It's very critical to the story. Many of you are talking about where you are in relation to where the federal government is, not necessarily the residential areas in DC. And so you do have this very interesting relationship in Washington, DC, where you could be on the street that is under, you know, the umbrella of the Washington, DC Police Department or the National Park Service, and you have, you know, federal law enforcement that would be more in charge of that. And so that really matters. And so let me just show this to you because I thought this was interesting. It's just the newsroom from what the Washington, D.C. This is giving me a little trouble here. I'm having a little stickiness, if you will, on some of our elements. So this is the Metropolitan Police for Washington, D.C. This is just their news releases. And so one of the things that came up just over the last 24 hours is the chief of police announces juvenile curfew zone in Navy Yard. We've seen this since early July, this summer, where these curfew zones are put into effect. And basically, it's to keep groups of kids. It's specific ages. Let me see if I think it lists it here. So within the juvenile curfew zone, persons 17 and under are prohibited from gathering in a group of 9 or more in any public space or on the premises of any establishment unless engaged in certain exempted activities. So that's from 8 p.m. to 11 p.m. beginning Sunday, August 10th, 10th lasting through Wednesday, August 13th. So they've been doing this periodically, saying like, hey, kids, you can't gather, you can't hang out together as a group in these certain areas with where they are seeing crime. Here's a couple, just again, news releases. Suspects saw it in South Capitol Street, armed robbery, arrests made and unauthorized use of a vehicle offenses. Metropolitan Police arrest Northeast burglary suspect. So these are, you know, we're in a major metropolitan area in the United States, and you will likely see crime in any big city in the United States. The question is like, well, what about that crime? If you do look at statistics, statistically in general, and this is through the reporting of the Metropolitan Police Department, violent crime overall compared to the same period last year is down about 26%. Homicides down 12%, assault with dangerous weapon down 20%, property crime down 4%, burglary down 20%, all crimes down 7%. This is preliminary data as we get, you know, from local law enforcement, but it's important. And it's what the mayor was talking about as well. But there may be some caveats to those numbers. So I want you to hear from the mayor of Washington, D.C. and her thoughts about what's happening in the city and also her personal exchanges with President Trump. It gives us a different point of view.
I have spent over the last 2 years driving down violent crime in this city, driving it down to a 30-year low, in fact. Over the past year, and thank you for showing, we have decreased violent crime by 26%, the year before that by 35%. It is true that we had a terrible spike in crime in 2023, but this is not 2023. This is 2025. And we've done that by working with the community, working with the police, working with our prosecutors, and in fact, working with the federal government.
When was the last time you talked to President Trump? And when have you talked to him about this?
I talked to him several weeks ago when we were in the Oval Office, and I've talked to him about crime repeatedly, including in my first meeting with him after he was elected. So the president is very aware of our efforts. He established a task force, which our police department and agencies support with information and anything else they ask us for. And so while it is always the president's prerogative to use federal law enforcement or the National Guard, even, you know, I've talked on your show before that the D.C. National Guard is the president's National Guard. Right. So that's always his prerogative. And federal law enforcement is always on the street in D.C. And we always work cooperatively with them. The National Park Service, for example, polices national parks. And then we have a lot of national parks. The FBI and ATF always work cooperatively with us on high-end or upper-level coordinated violent crime. And we've had some very successful takedowns with them. It is clear that the president, and I suspect that his announcement is that he is surging federal law enforcement, which he's talked about, and he may talk about even larger numbers or longer periods of time. He's interested in being in neighborhoods and fighting crime in neighborhoods. And to the extent that officers know our laws, that officers work in community and work with prosecutors to build good cases and establish a presence and work with local officials who are, you know, the experts in policing and making arrests, that's what we're waiting to see.
What a great insight from the mayor there to understand, listen, we work with federal, you know, law enforcement on a regular basis because of the unique nature of our city, and that she's open to a presence in certain neighborhoods. But there's a question of, well, what does that look like? Also, we have to be very careful. I said some this to you in the before show that we have for our insiders to join us live. One of the things I said is, you know, there was a way that this was presented publicly in the White House press briefing room, but when we look at the language of the declaration by the president, there's some nuances that are really important. For example, he didn't mobilize the National Guard today to march into Washington, D.C., as one could imagine, but that he basically gave that
that sort of oversight to the Pentagon to do as they see fit. So there's kind of this specifics of this language and what this actually looks like is going to be really important. So words are one thing, but what does it actually look like in action? It is important to know a little bit about DC and again, the unique nature of DC. Back in 1790, when it was becoming the nation's capital, it had so few people in it. There was no way that it was going to become a state. And that early voting took place. If you were a resident in Washington, D.C., and there's only a few thousand people that were, you would go to Maryland or Virginia. You were kind of in this in-between zone because there just wasn't a lot of people. As it became more populated, it became more important to the nation. It was clear that we had to figure something else out. But it has a very different makeup than any other city in the United States. So a little history here. In 1973, the D.C. Home Rule Act gave D.C. residents more control over their own local government. Congress, though, is the ultimate authority, and we have to keep that in mind. Congress really has a role here, but Congress, by the way, is back in their home districts for August. So this is happening in kind of an interesting time. Before 1973, before this act, Congress basically ran and made decisions related to the metropolitan area of Washington, D.C. But what the 1973 act did is it created what looks more like a typical city, which is why we can kind of loosely move into that feeling about Washington, D.C. Oh, yeah, it's like San Francisco. It's like L.A. It's like New York City. It's like Houston. It's not, though. It's not. The 1973 act created a mayor, so somebody that's locally elected. It created a city council. That city council has very similar powers to, let's say, your state legislature. So it is important. It can adopt laws. It can manage a budget. But Congress and the president still have a hand in how it's managed. The budgets have to be approved by Congress. Laws have to undergo congressional review and potentially can be nullified by the U.S. Congress. And Congress also has control over the court system. So that's also really important to know. Congress has a role. The federal government has a role in Washington, D.C. This is different than the federal government marching into Chicago. It just is. Doesn't mean it's right, doesn't mean it's wrong, just means it's a little bit different. Politico had a good way of describing this as well. And I wanted to read it to you because I thought it was a good way of summarizing it. Under the act that we were just talking about in 1973, DC has significant control of day-to-day local affairs. But the federal government, including federal law enforcement agencies such as the U.S. Capitol Police and the U.S. Park Police, retain control over federal land and property. And Congress has the final say on local DC policies. The Home Rule Act allows Congress to effectively veto any legislation passed by the DC Council. So what is going on then in Washington, D.C.? Some of you have talked about how you're feeling when you're visiting, how you feel around the city. In general, I have felt, just like many of you have, very safe in Washington, D.C. However, there are a few neighborhoods at night that were very clear that things change quickly from the day. And I'm born and raised in a city. You kind of notice that. And you move on because you're in a city and you're not from there. So you got to be in areas that are more familiar to you, that you feel more safe. And as a single woman, those are certain skills that you develop, just like any big city. This is true. One of the things that seems a little bit different about this situation that I think is getting lost and needs to be pulled out is about juvenile activity in Washington, D.C. And that's what I really want to ask the Metropolitan Police Department. I didn't have time before this was all breaking right before we got on the air, is how much the crime statistics, if it's a juvenile crime, is that also included in regular crime statistics? I'd be very curious. Maybe that's an obvious question of like, oh yeah, of course it is. But I'm curious about it because a lot of the reports that we've recently seen that have risen to national attention have involved younger people that are minors. Jeanine Pirro, who is now the Washington, D.C. Attorney General, spoke to this in the briefing room. And I want you to hear what she has to say.
We all want the same thing. We all want a safe city. We want a safe capital. We want to be able to bring our families here. We want to be able to come and enjoy the history that makes this place great. And unfortunately, we are not in that position right now. And Mr. President, I want to thank you for taking the step that we need right now to make criminals understand that they are not going to get away with it anymore. And I'm not going to stand here and go over and over the cases. But what I can tell you is this: I see too much violent crime being committed by young punks who think that they can get together in gangs and crews and beat the hell out of you or anyone else. They don't care where they are. They can be in DuPont Circle, but they know that we can't touch them. Why? Because the laws are weak. I can't touch you if you're 14, 15, 16, 17 years old and you have a gun. I convict someone of shooting another person with an illegal gun on a public bus in the chest, intent to kill. I convict him. And you know what the judge gives him? Probation. Says you should go to college. We need to go after the DC council and their absurd laws. We need to get rid of this concept of, you know, a no cash bail. We need to recognize that the people who matter are the law-abiding citizens, and it starts today.
So Jeanine Pirro, again, with some really strong words there, talking about what she's seeing in her just few weeks in her role in Washington, D.C. And so that question about adolescence is one that I just want you to keep in mind and wonder, how is that intersecting with the statistics picture? Or how is that intersecting with what the mayor is saying, what President Trump is saying, and what we're actually seeing in our nation's capital? I looked at the Washington Post, based in Washington, D.C., and I thought this was a very interesting anecdote, and I'm going to leave it here after this, because we can point to statistics that are preliminary and ask the question how reliable they are. We can ask the question how accurate the president's description is, and you know what he's seeing as someone that's hosting world leaders versus what a mother of three is seeing walking in her city that she's raised her children in. We can ask those questions and it's important, but what is it like for someone that's actually living in Washington, D.C.? What about the average person that's there? I hate that term, average person. What about just someone like us? This person was anonymous speaking to the Washington Post, but I wanted to read this final two paragraphs of this report. And I think This is where reporting comes in, because not just about the statistics is how you feel. And this is true about any data we're looking at. When it comes to the economy, the data, as soon as we get it, is old. It's backwards looking. It's a snapshot of a certain group of facts, but it may not really accurately reflect a feeling. And understanding how you feel about something as a voter, as a citizen, we really have to talk to you for that. So here's the quote. This is a safe city. But overhearing and witnessing gang threats and then watching the camera footage of the thuggery is disturbing, said one resident, speaking on the condition of anonymity over concerns of personal safety. The crowd of teens, he said, were roaming the street and appeared to be checking for unlocked cars and things to steal. Quote, the language Trump uses to describe DC is wrong, he said, but clearly there is something bad going on that needs to stop. So are we in a situation where two, three things can be true at one time, you know, that violent crime can be declining while there's a different threat that's emerging and the city doesn't feel good? What's the right way to solve that problem is up for a lot of debate, but it's a unique place in America. It is a reflection. It is our nation's capital. And so we'll see over the next couple of days, what does this actually look like? You know, are you going to see a bunch of officers on city corners? Like, what does it actually look like in practice? Because presence is one thing. Making arrests or targeting certain group, you know, neighborhoods or groups or something, that'll be something else. So we really need to see this in action to understand it. I thought also just kind of reflecting on as we bring our news stories together, when the president said, and by the way, I should have mentioned he made a mistake. He said a meeting with Vladimir Putin in Russia. Clearly, he meant he's meeting the Russian president, but he's meeting him in Alaska. Unless we're all going to Russia, we didn't realize it. I think it was just a slip of tongue. You know, does he really want to be talking about this right now? Is it an embarrassment for him as he's talking about it? Is it something that he just feels like that's not his standard as president, and he lives in the Capitol, so here he's going to make a change? Let me just see what else you guys have to say about how this is being reported and what your thoughts are on it. It looks like a lot of you are concerned about the adolescent side of this. You know, we're thinking about kids 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, and you know, these curfews that have been in place for weeks have been in place for a reason, clearly. Going into the summer, we were looking into curfew data to see could we actually extrapolate out of that and do a report on curfews and how effective they are. And it seems that it's more anecdotal than anything else. So it was hard to do a full report on it, but I thought it was pretty interesting just kind of thinking about that. So we'll see. Where do we go from here? What does it look like in action? Those are going to be the big things that we're going to be watching as we go into this week. So a lot of news in front of us. Let me just finish with a quick kind of fun story as we're drifting into the end of this report as well. I want to share this with you if I can. It's something unexpected. So on my Instagram account, on Smarter News, suddenly I'm getting referred to a lot of fishing videos. Why is that? You might ask. Jenna, are you suddenly taking up fishing? In which case I would say, I am not, but I have a 10-year-old that when he grabs my phone, which is very rarely, he gets in trouble for it, all he wants to do is Google fishing because he's really into fishing. So now I'm getting all of these like world record fishing recommendations along with workouts and news items on our Instagram account at Smarter News. But this was a great one. This is a very interesting story. It's a huge fishing tournament that's taking place in Maryland, I believe. I just want to make sure I get that right. Ocean City, Maryland. And it's the White Marlin Open. And the boat that you're seeing on your screen is Catch 23. And apparently there's a new fisherman in town that's just sort of cleaning up. And his name is Michael Jordan. Yep, Chicago Bulls. There he is standing there on the deck. I mean, I feel like he looks totally natural there. Right, hand on the hip. Might be more of a supervisorial role. He had his big old yacht, Catch 23, and he had a team participate in this tournament, and they actually got second place. I love this. It's always good to learn new skills. And if you got that competitive edge, you know, he went basketball, baseball, basketball, fishing. What's next? I don't know. But he's successful and quite a yacht. I mean, it's also like if you're on that team, like you feel pretty good because that looks like you know, just like the basics that I always ask about on fishing trips, like where do you go to the bathroom? Like on that yacht, you're not worried about it. Do you have ice? Yes, you do. Do you have shade? Absolutely. These guys look well taken care of and they're winners. Second place. They didn't get first place, but there's MJ looking proud as ever. Basketball to fishing just proves, guys, it's never too late to learn a new skill. All right. I'm going to leave you with that. Speaking of learning new skills, I talked about a 100-day project, Smarter in 100 Days. I just did a podcast about not drinking alcohol for 100 days and some of my observations related to that and some of the news stories that are tied to alcohol consumption. And I put forward a challenge for you about what we should do to become smarter in 100 days. We have 140, you know, again, 140 days left in the year, something like that. So what do you want to do for the next 100 days? What is something you can take away or just tweak a little bit? So you go into the holidays, you finish before Thanksgiving, okay? You finish before Thanksgiving and you feel good. People get all freaked out about New Year's resolutions. You've already made an improvement. I want to hear from you. What do you think are your plans for Smarter in 100 Days? What do you think our next project should be? Send me a voice note at hello@smarternews.com. I'd love to include it in a future podcast. All right, guys. Hope you have a great week. We'll pay attention to some of these big stories. A lot of them are in a certain stage of development, and we're not going to kind of get to the end now, but a lot to keep an eye on, and we'll make sure to keep you updated on smarternews.com. Have a great week wherever you are, and I'll see you soon on Smarter News. Bye, guys.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
If you work as a manufacturing facilities engineer, installing a new piece of equipment can be as complex as the machinery itself. From prep work to alignment and testing, it's your team's job to put it all together. That's why it's good to have Grainger on your side. With industrial-grade products and next-day delivery, Grainger helps ensure you have everything you need close at hand through every step of the installation. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.